Professor John Farina is an associate professor of religious studies at George Mason University. He's the director of the Global Religion and Civil Society Program that brings together the scholars in the United States, Europe and Asia to study the role of religion in contemporary civil societies around the world. Prior to coming to George Mason, he was a senior fellow at the Woodstock Theological Center at Georgetown University. There, he directed the Catholicism and the Civic Renewal Program, sponsored by the Henry Luce Foundation. John Farina specializes in the areas of religion and society, law and religion, American religious history, and the history of Western spirituality. He has practiced corporate and church-based law and published articles on current topics on law and religion. So we move from Europe to the United States, one laboratory to another one. I just would like to remind that one of the last book Samuel Huntington wrote just 2 or 3 years before his death was entitled Who Are We? And the book discussed the question of the American identity challenged by the flow of new migrants coming from Latinos countries. I think perhaps the American observatory is different from Europe, but sometimes there are some interconnection of topics and things. Please, John.
Thank you, Professor Pache, and thanks to the esteemed organizers of this conference for your invitation to be here. As Professor Beckermans noted in his introduction to the 2010 volume 2 of Pace Diritti Umani, the goals of the European Union, and in particular the goals of the Jean Monnet Center, are to present the EU in the world as a model for peaceful integration and dialogue. That dialogue is open to peoples within and without Europe. I'd like to take up that invitation as a non-European, although my European roots are not too distant with my Italian grandfathers coming to the United States at the beginning of last century. But the questions I wish to raise with you are, what role might religion play in the new Europe you wish to build? And more broadly, what role does religion play in civil society today? Those theoretical questions will be followed by two more empirical looks at recent attempts within the United States to bring religious organizations into partnerships with some government programs, some government social programs. Now, there are a number of immediate problems that such an undertaking faces. First, by way of definition of religion. There's always a debate about how big the definition of religion should be or how small. On one level, of course, religion is that institutional dimension that we associate with churches, mosques, and synagogues. But on the other hand, we can talk about personal beliefs and the way in which other elements of society, such as football, might demonstrate aspects of belief, loyalty, symbol, ritual. But for my purposes here, which are ultimately political, we can't really focus on the church of football. We have to mean here not simply the rights of the individual to believe, or the rights of conscience, or the individual's moral sense. We have to be, of course, religion deals with all of those things, but we have to be concerned not only with private rights of religious expression and religious freedom, but with institutional rights of religious organizations. The desire to make the EU a model for peaceful integration and dialogue among peoples and cultures strikes an outsider as, in one sense, surprising, given the awful history of conflict on this continent. And as we all know, religion has played a major role in that conflict. If we think back before the liberal era, we note that religion certainly played a great role in defining the other in a way that exaggerated difference and often encouraged inhumanity and violence in the name of God. It was for that reason, among others, that beginning with the French Revolution in the 18th century, European revolutionaries were forced to conceive of a new image of the human person that emphasized freedoms and individual rights. And that battle involved them with a battle against the church that resisted the growth of liberalism vigorously. No wonder, then, that anti-clericalism continues to mark so much of European liberalism. The rise of communism, of course, only exacerbated that problem. Islam in Europe, historically, also presented very serious problems for those interested in civilization based on peaceful integration and dialogue. No more tolerant than Christianity when it came to other faiths, Islamic insistence on joining mosque and state resulted in ongoing conflicts between non-Islamic regimes and their Christian or Jewish neighbors. Even now, as the Arab world erupts in calls for democracy and expansion of human rights, there still exist real questions about the compatibility of liberalism with Islam. Now, the liberal alternative has been well expressed in the French conception of laïcité. In its simplest form, citizens are asked to leave aside their religious convictions as they move into the sphere of the public. But even as the French, in rethinking back in 2006, the conception of laïcité and the Bernard Stassi Commission recognized, this idea of excluding religion from the public square simply does not meet the realities of today. You cannot champion human rights, individual expression, freedom of conscience, and then tell people they should leave aside their religion when they enter into public discourse. Religion for many is an integral part of their culture. The successes of liberalism in creating governments free from the oppression of organized religion has brought with it a new condition that, like many of the successes of liberalism, poses a problem for the very continuance of the system itself. Now that people are, for the most part, not worried that the church will be dominating their governments or that a new caliphate will be dictating their business practices anytime soon, they ask, why is it that my religious values cannot be reflected more in the public policies of my country? What is there about my religious values that make them different from my values about politics, about public values? How can I be respected as a human person if I must present a disintegrated self in public, one that hides away what I really feel and who I really am simply to validate a political regime? There seems nothing more opposed to the spirit of liberalism in one sense than that. Also, there's the problem of the third generation and social and cultural identities. In Great Britain, several of the perpetrators of the devastating terrorist attack there were in fact third generation Muslims who had been born and raised in the UK. Their adaptation of radical Islam represented a homegrown British model, not dissimilar to that displayed by several young men close to me in Northern Virginia who went off to Afghanistan to obtain military training as young jihadis. Now, questions like this, of course, lead me as an American to think of my own homeland, a place birthed by Europeans committed to the liberal ideals that they had long ago fostered. But there, because of a confluence of historical and geographical forces, a new order of the ages arose in which religion could be welcomed and at the same time separated formally from the state. And despite the worries that many of my European friends have and had, especially during the presidency of George W. Bush, that somehow religious leaders were whispering in the ears of our political leaders, hatching apocalyptic dreams that manifested themselves in unwise and often disastrous foreign policy moves, I would suggest that that's not the case. Rather, a closer look at religion's role in America shows that, on the whole, it functions to promote dialogue, social integration, pluralism, and respect for others, while at the same time providing many of the traditional values that religions have always provided societies: common values, common purpose, and solidarity. This, of course, was noted by that famous French observer of America, Alexis de Tocqueville. In the 1840s, he toured around the then still emerging country. He was writing for the French, and particularly for French who had real misgivings about democracy and its future. He immediately noticed, however, that religion, rather than contributing to social strife in the US, was in fact doing quite the opposite. Tocqueville's habits of the heart, chief among which were religion, worked to counterbalance the most threatening dynamic of a society based on freedom, which was individualism. Religion taught concerns for others, for the common good, for association. It worked against partisanship. Religious associations in America were not like secret societies in his homeland, or like clandestine political lodges that needed to plot for political change sequestered from the public eye. Because the churches were free from state oppression, their activities were not monitored by the police and not seen as a threat to the regime. Because of voluntarism and denominationalism, no one church dominated the culture or threatened the state. Religion was free to play a largely beneficial role in passing on social values essential to the health of the political society. Now, today I would suggest Europe has changed in several ways since the modern era that make it demographically appear more like the United States than it did before. It is not to say I'm suggesting that the US model be adapted. I realize there are profound differences. But nevertheless, in Europe, religious freedom is an established individual right that the individual may assert against the state. It's well protected in state constitutions throughout Europe. In fact, juridically, it has many more protections in most European constitutions than in the American Constitution. The American Constitution has two whole lines about religion, that's it. Second, religious pluralism is recognized by the states. Third, there's an increasing amount of religious diversity, often because of the presence of non-Christian immigrant groups. And fourth, religious organizations are, for the most part, not meddling in government affairs, I say, for the most part. The way that religion plays an important ongoing role in European cultures is through mechanisms, I would suggest, not unlike those Tocqueville observed in 19th century America. I'd like to discuss three such ways based on the research of three European thinkers, the French sociologist Daniel Héberger, Maurice Habermas, and Nicholas Luhmann by his student Peter Baer. Daniel Héberger, in her thinking about the problem of the future of the secularization thesis, noticed that the secularization theories of last century, that is, that religion would simply disappear as societies became more modern, simply haven't turned out that way. This led her to a study of social memory. She tried to outline the way in which religion functioned in the memory of society. Unlike in the past, the elusive sacred, she claims, is not easily limited to any one set of institutional symbols or policies, especially in so-called post-Christian Europe, when the dominance of the church has been effectively challenged by competing ideologies, most notably the ideology of non-belief. The religion endures, nevertheless, in the habits and memories of the society. It takes on old forms and often new forms that do not self-identify as religious, but that do perform religious functions within the society. Hence, we have the phenomenon of believing without belonging, or even belonging without believing. The question of how society creates and sustains the pre-political values necessary for its own continued existence may also be seen as a function of how a society structures its social memory. Maurice Habermas has shown memory is fundamental to the creation of a culture. The process by which we remember is in turn affected by the society. A society has a collective memory, which uses collective frameworks to restructure an image of the past that comports with the predominant thoughts of society. When society changes, it must change its current memory. It can do this by de-emphasizing some elements and emphasizing others, perhaps those that have been neglected before. Memory creates a fundamental difference, I think, between America and Europe. Apropos of Professor Pache's point, Bernard-Henri Lévy, writing retracing the steps of Tocqueville, wrote a book called American Vertigo, in which he said, America is built not on memory of the past, as he suggested France was, but on a dream about the future. He said Americans don't know much about their past and don't really know who we are presently, but we know who we want to be, or at least we talk a lot about who we want to be. However, I would suggest, isn't the EU certainly a dream about the future? And to dream it, does that not mean reconstructing the past and ceasing to be controlled by it? Part of reconstructing the past means reconstructing the memory about the role of religion in society. Even as Europe attempts to escape from a past of violence and mistrust, it, for the most part, is content to hold on to an old notion of religion as being anti-liberal, a force that must be controlled and limited in a democratic society, as if the state must protect people from religion. Anti-sect laws are completely incomprehensible to me as an American, as if people must be protected in addition to other legal protections that might exist, such as tort laws or criminal laws that would protect from the activities of a nefarious religious group. But somehow the idea itself functions as a kind of inchoate crime. I would suggest that this way of thinking is in one way a relic of the modern age, a relic of the wars of religion and of the time of revolutions. Being bound by it will hold back the new multicultural, multi-level Europe that you all seek. Now, Peter Baer, in his book on religion and globalization, argues that religion functions to create subsystems of meaning within cultures. In a functionally based society, traditional religion, which was a part of status-based society, has diminished. But religion, he points out, can also function well as a subset of functionally based societies, or modern societies. This is essentially the insight of Niklas Luhmann, Peter Baer's mentor. There are two approaches that religion might take in creating substructures within the new globalized societies. The conservative approach is to offer alternative identities that resist the new global identity and emphasize localism and particularism. The second, however, progressive approach is to de-emphasize the difference between religious identity and the new global social identity. In this model, religion encourages the breakdown of the old defining characteristics that marked particular religious identities in the past. The danger of the first approach is that it can be revanchist. The danger of the second is irrelevance. But if I am right about this, then where does this leave us? There's a need to enter into the kind of double learning that Habermas talks about in the political sphere when we talk about the role of religion in society. A new dialogue, then, between religion and liberalism must accept several changes. Valuing the role of religion in a liberal society, in fact, is not new and not illiberal. It's useful in this context to recall several famous liberal thinkers of the past saw the power of religion in society and wished to retain it in their new systems. Rousseau, in The Social Contract, devotes a good deal of that work, as is often forgotten today, to civil religion. However, he distinguishes what he calls the religion of humanity from the religion of the priests of the moment. And he talks about the need to retain the religion of humanity because of the social functions that it provides for society while displacing the religion of the priests. It's fitting here also to remember Giuseppe Mazzini, who in his writings often returns to the need for religion in the new liberal societies. Now, much has changed since the 18th and 19th centuries when religious organizations themselves opposed liberalism. Catholicism, for instance, has been brought, one might say, kicking and screaming into an accommodation of liberalism. The transformation of the church's opinion on this has been nothing short, in one sense, of astonishing, although it might not feel that way to you. But popes of the 20th century have been leaders in human rights in their opposition to war, in the insistence on the importance of the dignity of the human person. What has not happened until very recently is a concomitant change in the attitudes of the state, one must say more precisely, religions, European states toward religion. Now, this is not to say that this dialogue doesn't have to be two-sided. It requires that religions participating in civil society abide by the kind of religious tolerance and respect for religious freedom and the insistence on these things that did not mark the past. But this is, in fact, a two-way learning process, again, as Habermas has suggested. Now, postmodernity, what I'm suggesting, in many ways, is emerging not as a post-religious age, but as a post-secular age. And we will, I think, in that note, turn to some recent attempts in the U.S. to encourage partnerships between the government and religious bodies in developing civil society. I will start with one bad example. A number of years ago, I was asked to come into the Pentagon and talk to a group there that worked for the Department of Defense, lay people, working for the Secretary of Defense, whose job it was to reconstitute civil society in Iraq. 4 years into the invasion, they started off the meeting by saying to me, "We've noticed that religion is important for several members of the insurgency." I looked at them and I said, "You've just noticed." I knew the man had been put in charge of rebuilding civil society in Iraq. He was an American from Pennsylvania who had never been in the Middle East. He spoke no Middle Eastern languages. He had written some books on civil society in the United States. He was put in the position of Uday Hussein as the director of youth and sport. And he tells the story of going into one of these palaces, all the windows of which had been bombed out, so there was sand everywhere. So they had their little laptop computers in which wouldn't function. And then they were supposed to go out and meet people in the community, but they couldn't because they were being shot at. So after 6 months of this, in frustration, he bought 1 million footballs for the children and quit and went home. Perhaps a more hopeful initiative was something that started also during the presidency of George W. Bush in 2000. Most of you will not remember now when George W. Bush was elected president. Before 9/11, he said, "I want my presidency to be about domestic issues, not international issues." And one of the things that he had talked about was this program of using what they call faith-based initiatives, public-private partnerships, arguing that often church and religious groups were the people that in communities were the most close to the actual problems. So they should expand upon the ways in which the government could cooperate with those groups. Because of the acrimonious nature of the 2000 election, the Democrats were all for that idea. Al Gore was talking about the same thing in his political plank. But the Democrats simply made this a political football after the election and turned against this. And the thing became mired in many ways in political debate. Nevertheless, a number of things were achieved within several large administrative agencies of the U.S. government. Offices of faith-based initiative were created. Now, all of these, President Obama has kept the whole mechanism and indeed expanded it. What these offices had, their job was to provide ways for religious NGOs to get government money for various social programs. This, of course, has not been without controversy, but it has been by and large successful, and it's expanded the other ways, you know, the other indirect ways in which the U.S. government participates with religions through tax subsidies and other things. But specific programs where non-churches, I mean, people that might just have formed some NGO, based on religious ideas, could come to the government and would not have to pretend that they were doing something else, would not have to say, you know, we're really doing this because we believe Jesus told us to do it, but we can't present that in that language. The whole idea behind this was not necessary to do that, that you would not have to discuss, you would have to have civic purpose, secular purpose, but you did not need to completely translate that into a secular language. And by and large, this has been successful, a successful program over the years, which again, the Obama administration has expanded. So with that, I thank you.